Welcome to the Speak Like a Leader podcast with John Bates.
Welcome to the show. With me today is someone who maybe originally might have seemed like an unusual friend, not somebody that I expected to have in my life. And he's turned out to be just one of the most inspiring, impactful, wonderful friends that I have. And he's someone with very different perspectives than I have. And yet we manage to see the world in the same way so many of the times. And I believe that the differences in our perspectives make our friendship vastly deeper and richer than it would be otherwise. And his name is Howard Stevenson. And Howard is a former Utah State Senator. Did I get that right, Howard?
Yes.
And you ran the Utah Taxpayers Association for how many years?
44.
So welcome to the show, Howard. I am thrilled to be talking with you. And I really appreciate you being willing to come on the show and share your lessons in leadership and communication and share what you're up to in the world with all of us. So thanks and welcome.
Thank you so much. It's good to be with you, John.
So let's start, Howard, with kind of your experience of 44 years running the Utah Taxpayers Association, being a state senator. I know that there are, you know, like that's a wild world, politics, right? And communication and leadership is like, that's what it's all about on some level. So what are some of the things that what's one thing that you would say you learned over your career in politics that could be super useful for anybody in, you know, just in their life in general? I know that's kind of a big, yeah. Don't mean to dump that on you right at the very beginning, but I think you've got a great answer, I'm sure.
Well, it's true. I thought coming into politics, you know, I started as a 13-year-old, I saw Ronald Reagan's A Time for Choosing, a fundraiser that was broadcast multiple times on television for a half an hour. And I watched it multiple times and I just thought, that's what I want to do. I want to keep government off our backs and out of our pockets. And so I got my master's degree in public administration so I would know how the enemy thinks, not so I could be a government administrator.
Right.
And I had some very concrete ideas about correct principles.
Right.
And I still believe in those correct principles, but probably the biggest thing I've learned is that regardless of where we stand on the political spectrum, we are required to have empathy for other ideas, to listen. I think it was Robert F. Kennedy who said, liberty carries with it an equal responsibility. So all liberties are countered like a yin and a yang with a responsibility that accompanies it. And he said that we are required, we are obligated to listen to the other side without having to have an ulterior motive of convincing the other person, but instead of listening with empathy. And that was a long time in coming for me. It wasn't always easy because I was so sure of right and wrong.
Right. Well, you had a big awakening around that, I guess, a number of years ago. Do you mind sharing that story with us? Because I think it's such a fabulous, fabulous story, Howard.
Sure. I was that legislator who, when I entered the legislature in 1993 in the Utah Senate, where I served ultimately for 26 years, that I wanted to change public education and to get them out of the business of being a social service agency. And I just said, darn it, just teach our kids and then everything will be okay. And so I led the charge against school breakfast, which was something that a lot of the liberals in my mind were pushing at that time. And it was nonsense because we were sending our kids to school fed. Why should schools try to replace the family? I was against after school programs. We were running our kids to soccer and to music lessons. And we had a full calendar of stuff that my wife, mainly because I was at work, were doing. And all the people in our neighborhood were busy doing those things as well after school. I opposed all-day kindergarten because our five-year-olds didn't need more than 3 hours of school. You know, they need to play more. They don't need to be at the grind in school for a full day of kindergarten. I opposed school psychologists. We don't need shrinks in our school. Just do your job. Teach our kids reading, writing, and math. And how hard can that be? And I was frustrated that the data show that 2/3 of kids in America are below grade level in reading, writing, and math. And I said, just do your job, doggone it. And then something happened. Julie signed us up to be counselors, volunteer counselors in the Salt Lake Valley Youth Detention Facility. She's always looking to serve in the community. In fact, today as we speak, she has our dog Reggie, an English retriever, at the hospital visiting children in the hospital where she is a volunteer. That's the kind of person I married. And she's been such a blessing to me.
That's awesome.
So on the first day at detention, we were shocked to see these kids who had been breaking the law. And when we got in the car, we both said to each other that the only difference between those kids and our kids was environment. If our kids had been switched at birth, we might have been visiting our own. It's their environment that has created them to be in the detention center. And so we taught them a non-denominational Sunday school each Sunday. And on Tuesday and Wednesday evenings, we engaged them with life skills so that they would learn to self-regulate and feel positive about themselves and realize that despite their circumstances, they could succeed. I have to tell you that as I looked into their faces each day, I seriously wondered if they were there because of me, because I had denied them that after-school program. They returned home to an empty house and wandered the neighborhood looking for belonging and found it in gangs. Mm. I wondered if they hadn't succeeded in school because they didn't get the 30 million words that the middle-class kids get before they turn five, and therefore their brains are wired for learning. And kids who don't receive those words and aren't engaged with educated parents and middle-class environment are really denied, and their brains are not wired for the learning in the classroom. And they really did need an extended day kindergarten, which I denied them. They needed breakfast so they could have the blood glucose in their brains to do the work of learning. Some of those kids were suffering from what is called ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. And these can range from everything but from the worst abuse that you can imagine to neglect. And with those adverse childhood experiences, these kids come to school fearful of who they can trust, for example. And so they need a licensed psychologists to assist them in working through their fears and their trauma. And so my whole attitude about understanding the role of schools changed, because I realized that the kids who are with highly educated parents and a middle or upper middle class lifestyle may not need school breakfast, but there are some kids who do. Those kids may not need after school programs, but there are some neighborhoods that it would be a godsend. And so I changed my whole attitude about denying those things. And by the way, when I was fighting against those things, I was successful in getting my colleagues to oppose them too, saying, just do your job, schools. And now I realize that the job of schools is much bigger than I had imagined. So I became a strong advocate of school breakfast, of full-day kindergarten for some kids, for school psychologists. And I sponsored the school psychologist legislation in my very last year in the Utah State Senate. And I was a strong advocate of after-school programs for those kids who simply don't have adult supervision when school is over. And in fact, now I helped to form a charter school in one of the lowest income neighborhoods in Utah, where we provide school breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and after school programs. And we send them home with a backpack of food on the weekends, because we realize that not all kids are like those in my middle class neighborhood.
You know, and what I love, Howard, is that I love what you have to say about that being actually a really smart, fiscally conservative way to spend money.
Absolutely. I learned that the cost of not providing those things, by the way, the cost of those things is very minor. It's just a marginal cost difference, and it's not on a statewide basis. It's for those neighborhoods and those kids that need those services, those wraparound services, as we call it. The cost of that is so minor compared to the social service and corrections, law enforcement, victim reparations costs that come later when we fail to meet those kids' essential needs. And yeah, they then become wards of the state in one way or another. Just the welfare costs later on from somebody who's not able to succeed with a self-sustaining job that suits them, that alone is far greater through the life of that individual than the cost of providing these low-cost services while they are in the schools and before.
Yeah, I mean, which I think is a pretty great insight. And, you know, just as an aside, Howard, I don't know if I ever told you this, but my grandfather was very active during the Depression in lobbying Congress for the school lunch program. In fact, he got an invitation from Colonel Sanders when he started Kentucky Fried Chicken to come be his right-hand man. And my grandpa actually turned that down because he was too involved in lobbying for the school lunch program, because during the Depression, kids were coming to school so hungry they couldn't learn.
Yeah.
So wow, kind of an interesting parallel there.
What a great connection.
That's cool. Well, so you know, I think that to me is just it's just such a generous willingness that you show to really, I mean, down to the foundations of who you viewed yourself as, to be open to that, I just think is one of the things that I love and respect most about you. So I think that's just such an important story for everybody, you know, to be able to let go of our darlings that way, in a way, you know, and not hold a fixed position even in the face of evidence against it. Right.
Yeah.
And so that kind of changed your path and had you get aware of a lot of other things, I think. And that experience has directly informed what you're up to now. Yeah.
Yeah, it really did. I sponsored legislation for computer-assisted instructional software to give teachers the 21st century tools they need to meet the needs of every child, because the brain research has shown that when someone gets immediate interactive feedback, especially when it's through software that is adaptive, so that you're not drilling the kid through 10 of the same problem when they got it right the first few times. That kind of software for reading, writing, and math has been proven to be a godsend for teachers who will use it with fidelity and let go of their sage on the stage presence when it comes to reading, writing, and math. I'm not talking about the upper levels of what are called Bloom's taxonomy, such as critical thinking, synthesis, evaluation, creativity. Those are things that require a teacher example and engaging the kids. But we have found that a kid can learn sine and cosine a lot better through a computer-assisted instruction software than they can with a teacher standing on a stage with a class that's 5 years at least between the top and the bottom students, with a bell-shaped curve of distribution of kids' abilities. And so they tend to teach to the middle of the bell-shaped curve, where the kids on the right are bored and the kids on the left are lost. And that's part of the reason that 2/3 of American kids are below grade level in reading, writing, and math. And so I after learning the brain research on that, I got a passion for giving kids the immediate, interactive, adaptive feedback they need to become competent in reading, writing, and math. And it's making such a huge difference. We started with a pre-kindergarten program that that we have now in Utah that has been amazing in getting kids to begin kindergarten on the very first day at a first grade level.
That's so fabulous. That's so fabulous. And Johnny's been, my son Johnny has been participating in that.
Did you know that that was a Hail Mary? When we instituted that, that was just a Hail Mary pass, not knowing whether it was going to work or not. And now it has been labeled by TED Global as one of 8 audacious ideas that can change the world. And it truly is changing the world. And they've raised money to put a pilot in every state so that state legislatures will make it universal for every kid, every 4-year-old, so they can really start kindergarten at a first grade level. We were the 11 states without a bricks and mortar pre-K were invited to Big Sky, Montana, where the Pew Charitable Trusts had teams from each state to develop a strategy for doing pre-K, because the research has shown that early childhood education is so important to later success in school. And we realized that we don't have a lot of money in Utah, because we have most of our kids in public schools, unlike other states that have a lot of private schools and other things like that. And so we decided to have a program that would be home-centered, rather than displacing what parents were already spending on their 4-year-olds. We would add to that through a home-based computer-assisted instruction. And our team, which I was on because I chaired the education committee, decided to do it that way. And we put an RFP out there for bids to see if somebody had that. A Utah-based company, Waterford, had just the right thing. Plus, we required there to be a third-party evaluation every year to make sure it was having an effect. Otherwise, we would pull the plug on the funding. Mm-hmm. And it had such a profound effect that the third-party evaluator found that on one evaluation, these kids were twice as prepared as kids who didn't get the program. And on another evaluation, they were 3 times as prepared. And longitudinal long-term effects show that 4 years later, in fourth grade, 5 years later in fourth grade, these kids are 20, 30 points of proficiency above their cohort that didn't get the program. And so now those low-income minority special ed and English learners in Utah that typically are not at grade level by third grade are a year ahead on the first day of kindergarten.
Wow. Which is just so fabulous. And, you know, one of the things that I've heard you say is, you know, at first kids need to learn to read because very quickly school becomes reading to learn. So that, you know, one of the things that I didn't understand, Howard, that I think is really important for people to get is that it starts so much earlier than I realized, you know, this two-track system where some kids are just behind and then they just can't catch up. And that's why, because if you don't learn to read right then, you know, kindergarten, first grade, school very quickly becomes reading to learn. And if you don't read, you can't learn, right?
Absolutely. And what we've learned is that these kids in these disadvantaged groups have 100 billion brain cells, just like kids in middle-class families. Mm. But they typically don't have the parent support, not necessarily because the parents don't care, but because they don't know what they don't know. And they are so busy trying to make ends meet that single mom, for example, may be doing two jobs and so just can't provide the support those kids need. And we can provide that both before they enter the formal education system through the Upstart program as four-year-olds and throughout the K-12 system as well. We can provide those wraparound services that make up for the fact that some kids don't get the supports they need in their family life. Yeah. It's so proven that we can do this. But unfortunately, a lot of teachers and a lot of school systems don't know what they don't know. I was speaking at a conference in Hilton Head, South Carolina, where they had a few dozen superintendents from South Carolina and Georgia. And I gave the presentation about what they can do by using computer-assisted instruction to do the heavy lifting of personalized instruction for a teacher so that the teacher can then be free to do the careful one-on-one work without a lot of pressure. What I tell them is teachers are working too hard. We need to enable them to not work so hard because they're pedaling as fast as they can and not getting where they need to be because we haven't given them the tools to personalize learning in reading, writing, and math for every child.
Well, you know, it reminds me of some of this stuff that we've talked about, Howard, in our work together. And I think one of the things I guess here's how I'd say it. My sister is a teacher, and she's actually a special ed teacher and has done that for her whole life. And one of the things that I think is true about just any teacher, especially in a public education setting, is that teachers are stubborn. And thank heavens they're stubborn, because if they weren't stubborn, they could never do their job. And at the same time, it's that kind of live by the sword, die by the sword thing, that very stubbornness that makes them able to do their job also makes it really hard to change that world and bring new innovations and new ways of doing things to that world. And I think that it's a little bit frustrating to try to communicate this. What have you been taking on and coming up with over the years to actually get heard versus just, you know, be mad that they don't hear you.
Yeah, it's the data and and examples of teachers who have used the software with fidelity that help people to understand. When they hear what can happen without a teacher for four-year-olds, entering kindergarten, basically at a first grade level, on average, for the most disadvantaged kids, starting kindergarten at that level is a game changer. And it piques their interest. They say, how is that even possible? Then when we show, for example, a fourth grade class of Sonia Olson's, who 38 kids in her classroom, and two-thirds of them were below grade level at the beginning of the year. At the end of the year, because she used the software with fidelity, meaning she had the kids on it the right number of minutes each week, and celebrated with them at the end of each week that everybody got their minutes, and talked about the year-end celebration they were going to have when everybody made at least 1 year of growth, and then following through consistently week after week after week, at the end of the year, 95% of her 38 kids were at grade level or above. Two-thirds of them were a full grade ahead when two-thirds of them started the year at least a grade behind. And the only two who didn't make grade level were special ed students, who made the biggest gains of all because they were floundering at a first grade reading level and now are reading at a advanced third grade level. They made the biggest gains of all. So she invited me to the school to help give out the awards at the end of the year. And I've never seen more tears in an elementary auditorium as I did that day with those low-income families there to support their children, realizing that the trajectory of their child's life had been forever changed by Mrs. Olson. And as I share that experience with superintendents and other instructional leaders, they begin to realize that there's a better way than teacher sage on the stage, spray and pray kind of concept, sit and get. Mm-hmm. Instead, every child is getting what they need in front of the computer for 20 minutes a day on math and 20 minutes a day on reading. It's not spending your whole life on screen time. It's just episodes of high quality screen time,
right,
to get the kids at grade level and meet them where they are and move them forward as quickly as they are able as an individual, rather than this batch processing system that we've had throughout the 19th century and until now. And I remember at one conference, a Black superintendent came up to me afterward and said, "Until I heard your presentation, I never imagined that I had been hurting kids. And now I realize that I need to change, and I need to change my school system." It was kind of like me being at the detention center, realizing how badly I had hurt kids. And it's really heartwarming to see education leaders embrace this new science of learning that can reach every single child.
It's so wonderful. And Howard, you know, that story with the superintendent, I think that, you know, that is exactly why I think it's so fabulous and so important that you tell your story, right? And your story is an example of what I call insightful vulnerability. You're being vulnerable, you're sharing an aha moment you had when you got that something that you held near and dear that you thought was really important, you were wrong about it, you know, and you had an epiphany and you changed what you were doing. That's a hard, hard thing for people to admit and to share. However, the fact that you do that so generously and that you do that in front of these big audiences of people, it opens up the possibility for them to do the same thing. And that's exactly what that guy said to you, right?
Yeah.
Until I heard your story, I didn't realize I could be doing that. And when he heard your story, he was able to admit it to himself because you had to yourself.
You know, there are a couple of other areas like that that were really mea culpa moments, epiphanies for me. One of them was to do with undocumented kids, you know, that crossed the border with their parents as a young child. And now they are in our high school systems, and some of them are our student body officers, our valedictorians, our head cheerleaders, our captain of the athletic team. And yet in most states, they are not able to attend college and live the American dream because of this notion that they are international students because they're undocumented. And so I sponsored legislation. I was a Senate sponsor for the DREAM Act in Utah. We're one of the first and still one of the only state legislatures to pass the DREAM Act, meaning that if you're an undocumented kid in America and you play by the rules, because you couldn't have stomped your foot at the border and said, "Mom and Dad, I'm not going to come with you to America because even though you're seeking liberty, you're seeking opportunity, I'm not going to come with you because I happen to know the laws in America and I don't want to break the laws." Well, when they get here and they're required by the federal government to attend school and they succeed, to tell that kid that young man that you can't live the American dream because your parents brought you here undocumented. That is to say, well, you might as well join a gang because you're not like our kids, even though you are in the same classes, doing the same things and succeeding and playing by the rules. We're going to treat you differently. You have to sit on the back of the bus. It would be like telling that young woman, you might as well get pregnant and start an early family because you can't go to college. And so the bill passed the House initially with only one extra vote. It was very, very divided. And when it got to the Senate, we were three votes short of a majority that we needed, but I decided to run the bill anyway. And during that debate, there's not many times that the debate on the floor makes a difference on a bill because the votes are already pretty hardwired and everybody understands the issue. But as I explained, the fact that these kids are our kids, that they deserve the same opportunity that our kids do because they have played by the rules. They're not getting a special preference. They're just not being denied the same opportunity our kids have. I remember one, and it passed by a veto-proof majority. It just
wow.
Flipped because we engaged their hearts and minds about these kids are human kids. They're not those other people. They are our kids. I remember one elderly senator statesman came up to me after the vote with tears in his eyes saying, "I had committed to vote no on that bill, but when I heard this description of who they are, I realized we cannot discriminate against them simply because their parents brought them here as young people. They are our kids and they deserve the same success." And right now, last session, we worked with the Arizona legislature to get on their ballot this coming November, a measure that will overturn a previous ballot measure that barred these kids from attending college at the same in-state tuition that their classmates in high school are able to obtain. And it looks like it's going to pass in Arizona. The hearts and minds of people have changed.
Wow.
That's really cool.
Another area where there was a change of attitude was on racial issues, especially with African Americans, and even the Martin Luther King holiday. Many so-called conservative states were reluctant to adopt the Martin Luther King holiday as a state holiday, even after it had been identified as a national holiday. And we worked with legislators to help them understand that Martin Luther King and his vision was something we would want for every human. He was somebody who understood correct principles of judging people by the content of their character and not by the color of their skin or any other number of things. And so I remember those debates about the Martin Luther King holiday and also about anti-discrimination. Utah became one of those first states, even though we are the reddest of the red states, we became one of the first states to pass a statewide non-discrimination bill that you cannot discriminate on housing and employment based on a person's sexual orientation or religion or any of those other factors. And a few weeks after Utah made international headlines for doing that, the state of Indiana did just the opposite. And hopefully they will come around to the fact that we are all God's children, no matter the color of our skin, the nationality, our sexual orientation, our religious beliefs. We are all God's children, and we need to treat each other as brothers and sisters.
It's so fabulous. I mean, I think one of the things you know, I grew up Mormon, and I don't consider myself religious at this point, but I have certainly a spiritual component to my being and my life. And I think one of the things that is pretty cool about the Mormons is that they have the experience of having been persecuted. I mean, flat out, you know. And I think that brings a compassion to the approach that's just a really good thing. And you know, one of the other things that I think about as I hear you talk is the climate today, you know, and I just want to acknowledge you for being somebody who's out there bringing the humanity back to our conversations. One of my favorite books is called Survival of the Friendliest. And it's a relatively new book. And it talks about the fact that human beings essentially took over the earth, you know, Homo sapiens took over the earth because we developed the ability to be kind to each other, to be friendly. We developed the ability to extend that kindness beyond our single local tribe. And that opened up trade and all, you know, specialization and just all kinds of benefits to us as a species. And I think that's just a really good guiding principle as we look at our, you know, discourse today and at our approach to things today, because fundamentally the reason we are successful is because of our ability to be friendly to each other and to, you know, agree to disagree and still cooperate and things like that. And so, you know, I want to acknowledge you for being one of those calming voices and one of those voices that I think is really bringing goodness and healing versus just, you know, opprobrium and dehumanization like I think we see too much of out there.
Well, that means a lot. Thank you so much. But I have to say it wasn't always that way for me in the, in the legislative process, because I thought I knew what was best, given my limited perspective in my neighborhood, for example. Mm. The thing that troubles me more than anything today is the political polarization that exists with with the personality cult worshiping and the talking past each other. And there are news outlets now that make a lot of money by that polarization. Even the social media makes money on that polarization. Yeah. It's sort of a new polarization industrial complex that is more concerned about lets you and him fight as opposed to finding common ground. And I frankly don't see a light at the end of the tunnel right now, because people have chosen their sides and they aren't willing to sit down and have a rational conversation with somebody of a different political viewpoint. It's just, it's frightening to me to see what's happening. I don't know what the end of it will be. I raised this question at a national conference where Newt Gingrich was speaking, and I said, Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, opposite parties, were obviously respecters of one another. And if you want great humor, look at some of the YouTube videos of Ronald Reagan roasting Tip O'Neill. It's just hilarious. And and you see genuine compassion they have for each other. And when Tip O'Neill's Democrat House of Representatives was opposing Ronald Reagan's proposed tax cuts, and you see the two of them on the phone together with Tip O'Neill conceding, saying, "Mr. President, you beat us fair and square." And the deferential treatment they had toward each other. And I pointed out that Newt Gingrich, you and Bill Clinton balanced the budget. You got the biggest welfare reform through Congress. What's the answer? How are we going to overcome the toxic political polarization that exists today? And his answer, in a nutshell, was the American people will be fed up with it, and they will be the ones that will bring us back toward the center.
Well, you know, Howard, it reminds me of something that dawned on me a little while ago that in a way made me almost more scared, which is that, and you know, with all due respect to you and your background as a politician, it dawned on me that politicians in many senses are not leaders. They're by the nature of the job, they are followers of their constituents, right? They have to be representing their constituents' desire or they're out of a job. And so, you know, so much of this I want to blame on the politicians, and yet that's not really, I think, squarely where the blame lies. I think I tend to agree with that comment. You know, like, it's up to us as the voters, as the American people, to get fed up with this polarization and bring our politics back in line, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the one of the areas that I think that has to occur before we destroy our whole history is regarding the symbols that we have in this nation, the monuments and all of those things. We have the tallest building in Washington, D.C. is the Washington Monument, and yet he was a slaveholder. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, and when he said all men are created equal, he didn't mean white men. He knew that that included his own slaves, but it had to be aspirational, because if we had tried to cure slavery with the founding of America, with a revolution, it couldn't have happened. We would have had a divided nation to begin with. And so from the time that the Declaration of Independence declared that all men are created equal, it was aspirational. And it took 89 years before Abraham Lincoln to finally pass the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment and to end slavery, which time he was assassinated for that. And then it took another 99 years for us to finally pass the Civil Rights Act, which Eisenhower tried to get through. But as a senator from the South, Lyndon Johnson killed it each time. But as president, Johnson signed it, and he said, we are ceding the Southern states to the Republican Party by doing this. And then the next year, fortunately, he got through the Voting Rights Act, which stopped this Jim Crow idea of preventing blacks from voting in the South. But then he also passed the Great Society legislation regarding welfare that basically destroyed the poor and black American families by ensuring that there's not a father in the home. There's answers to that today that we probably don't have time to get into, but
and you're working on them, I know.
Yeah. But if we can't admit that this nation was systemically racist between the Declaration of Independence and the end of slavery, then there's something wrong with our reasoning. And if we can't admit that the nation was at least institutionally racist between 1865 and 1964 with the passage of the Civil Rights Act, when blacks had to sit on the back of the bus, couldn't use the same drinking fountains, bathrooms, etc. If we can't say that we were institutionally racist, then there's something missing in our ability to admit our history. And people say, well, that wasn't me, or it wasn't my ancestors, it was those other whites that did that. Well, we're straining at gnats at that if we're saying that that wasn't me and therefore it's okay. But today we have a worse thing where we have basically taken fathers out of the home through our welfare system. And I want to fix that through a earned income tax credit rather than requiring that the father be gone in order for people to make a livable wage.
Right. Well, you know, I know that we're up against our time, and I would actually love to have you come back again sometime down the road, Howard, and check in with us and tell us how things are going. What I wonder is there any place that people can go to find out more about you, find out more about what you're up to? Can you give us some links, and I'll put them in the show notes as well?
Yeah, probably the best way is by giving my email and my phone number. That I'd love to talk to people directly. I have some stuff, but my website is not up yet. Somehow something happened to it that I can't explain. But
okay,
we'll get.
Well, once it's up, let me know, and I'll put that in the show notes for future listeners. And what's the best email for you then?
Howard Stevenson at me@myself.com.
Okay.
And it's spelled with a PH and an SON. One word, Howard Stevenson.
Great. Okay, good. I will put that in the show notes and people can email you there. Do you want me to list your phone number, or do you want to they could email you and then you could give them your phone number?
I've always listed my mobile number as a state senator, and it's
great.
Amazing how people are respectful, but I love to get texts and calls from people who want to share ideas.
So that's 801, or is it?
Yes, it's 801-815-6800, 815-6800.
Awesome. Well, Howard, thank you very much, first of all, for joining me on the show today and for being so generous with your time and what you're up to. And thank you as well for who you are in the world and what you're putting your energy towards accomplishing. And again, I just want to thank you for being one of those kinds of people that I find to be, it's one of the most inspiring things that I think ever happens with human beings, is someone who's willing to have an epiphany, who's willing to change their mind, and who's willing to go out and put their shoulder to the wheel about it. I'm just so inspired by you, and I'm so glad you're in my life. I'm glad I know you, and I'm glad you're out there doing what you're doing. And thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time on SpeakLikeALeader.show.
Thank you for joining the Speak Like a Leader podcast. Go be awesome.